Hello, listeners. Welcome to the Wisconsin Climate and Energy Broadcast, a show about clean energy and climate change, ranging from reducing carbon in our atmosphere to adapting to ever-increasing severe weather. The Wisconsin Climate and Energy Broadcast is a project of the Perpetual Notion Machine. Here are your hosts from the Wisconsin Academy of Sciences, Arts and Letters, John Greenler and Jessica James.
Hello, I'm Jess James, one of the co-hosts of the Wisconsin Climate and Energy Broadcast. Each month, we bring you different stories, ranging from climate-critical lands in Wisconsin to emerging technology and policies in clean energy and climate. Thank you for tuning in tonight to our show. This is a recording from late July with Andrew Stoltman at Kemp Natural Resources Station in the Northwoods of Wisconsin. Andy works for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources and is currently the Forest Economics and Ecology Section Chief in the Division of Forestry. He is perhaps most proud of having been one of the authors of The Ecological Landscapes of Wisconsin. Thanks again for tuning in tonight, and I hope you enjoy the show.
So Andy, where are we today, and what's the history and significance of this place?
We are at Kemp Natural Resources Station, which is owned by the University of Wisconsin. It is just north of Rhinelander. And the significance of this place is that it was donated by the Kemps to the university, I believe in the 40s, although I'm not exactly sure on the dates. But it has now been used basically as a research hub and a learning hub.
It's a beautiful spot that we're standing in here. And really nice day after a lot of rain yesterday. So this is really a pleasure. So one of the focuses of our conversation today is how forests are critical for addressing today's climate change concerns and challenges. What is the relationship between forests, such as where we are right now, and climate change, or more specifically, carbon in the atmosphere versus or in relationship with carbon in trees and the soil?
Right. So we're standing in a system here that is muchly hemlock. It would be a system where the soil and the moisture regime are sort of mid-range, maybe a little rich, maybe a little poor, depending on the microsites. But there's a lot of big, old trees here, 100 years old, likely, in a lot of cases here. And with that, there is a lot of carbon stored in the system here, and even more so in the soils around this area. This is an area with an undisturbed forest, which is really important. For at least around 100 years, we would have a guess at here. And that's allowed the carbon in the soil to continue to accumulate. And these trees suck carbon out of the atmosphere and turn it into biomass. And that's just the cool thing about the machine that is a plant. They all do it. An interesting piece about this and the carbon that's around here is, as we've talked about a little bit earlier, this system has a somewhat depauperate understory, as in it's pretty sparse, and that has a lot to do with the shading of these big old hemlocks. There just isn't a lot of sun that hits the ground, and therefore this particular forest system is one of those where there wouldn't be a lot of carbon in the understory, as opposed to some of the other forest systems that we find in Wisconsin.
Yeah, so it's kind of up high in the canopy and down in the soil. Yeah, interesting. So, and that's kind of that miracle of photosynthesis, right, in terms of talking about these big trees being able to take the carbon out of the atmosphere through energy from the sun, essentially, right, and then pack it into the trees, which then, I guess, correspondingly really then allow that carbon, as the trees turn over or the roots or whatever to go into the soil.
Right, exactly. And some of that cycling, again, occurs based on some of the disturbance that happens. So, for example, over this general direction, there is a very spotty wind throw event that happened about 20 years ago. It was in 2000. And, it kind of popped, an acre or two here and an acre or two there to create these gaps. And the really cool thing about that when we're talking about carbon is that when there is a good set of advanced regeneration of trees that are already established, and maybe they're small, seedlings or saplings, but when they get that opportunity, when that sun, the canopy is gone, that sun gets down to the ground, they explode in growth. And what that creates, of course, is a fast-growing forest where there's a lot more carbon actually being sucked out of the air. Now, you've lost some carbon by actually the event that knocked the trees over. And those trees laying on the ground will slowly decay and release more of the carbon that they've stored, but it isn't a catastrophic event. It's a slow event. So these little patches are really important ecologically for a lot of the birds and bugs and mammals and reptiles that use these areas, because it creates a little bit of heterogeneity in the landscape and offers some microclimates that some of these organisms need for some part of their life cycle. So it's not only about the carbon and the difference between sort of what's stored in these big old forests and in these younger forests where things are being sucked out really quickly. It's also about providing that habitat, these co-benefits. And there's so many things that these forests provide: clean drinking water, clean air. They you know, prevent erosion and soil disturbance. And what happens when we have these sort of catastrophic land use changes, we can end up emitting more carbon. And especially if this goes from forest to some other land use, you can rapidly lose the carbon that's in the soils.
Yeah, so just coming back to those co-benefits, it seems like that's such an important consideration to keep in mind of where carbon is in these natural systems and how we can utilize that to address climate change. But clearly, we don't want to do that at the price of all these other things that we value, and kind of that biodiversity we're talking about seems especially important.
Yeah, and there's a good way of thinking about that, I think, is if we were simply talking about carbon and sequestering carbon, we might think about just allowing the forest to get old and accumulate carbon. But when we're talking about the importance of, for example, the habitat that needs of many different species, we can't necessarily think this way. So I think the best way of looking at managing for climate change when we're talking about forests, we're looking at this dynamic system across the landscape that is offering different benefits at different times. So for example, we want to make sure that across the landscape that all forest types are represented in all age groups, because we don't want to necessarily just have all our eggs in one basket. You want to have that wide landscape diversity of different types. In the climate change perspective, by keeping, for example, forest land in forest land, even if there's harvesting going on, you're limiting the amount of carbon that's being emitted by soil disturbance. Right. So management to maintain these different cereal stages, these ages of different forest types, is a good thing. Think about it rotating through time, that we want to have a certain amount of young forest, a certain amount of middle-aged forest, and a certain amount of old forest. And again, this concept of co-benefits, we're thinking about that ecology. We're thinking about all the great things that forests do for us, which I mentioned a little earlier, water being one of those really important pieces. Forests do such an incredible job in cleaning water that we end up drinking. And also thinking about, I mean, I'm a forester, so I talk a lot about forests, but with these other habitats, so people are saying, you know, trees, they hold carbon. Well, we should plant everything to trees. And that isn't the case that we need to think about. We also need to think about the open habitats that a lot of species in our state and in the region require for part of their life cycle. We need prairies. We need wetlands. We need all natural communities well represented on our landscape. So I believe, and again, I work for the Department of Natural Resources. This is sort of our charge. We have a responsibility to look at the importance of the ecology and the economy and the social benefits that these places provide for us. And here we are sitting in this incredible old cool forest. And I don't know about you, but it brings a warmth to my heart. There's a sense of just beauty and however you want to say it, being in the natural world that is so cool, so almost indescribable. It reduces my stress. I love being out here. I'm not out here enough.
It is pretty breathtaking. It's pretty extraordinary. Yeah, and I think there's an increasing body of research which does talk about the psychological effects, you know, that one experiences in being in a place that is so rich, you know, in its natural dimensions as this. And that's a co-benefit, right? Yes. So absolutely. Yeah. I want to come back to a point you made earlier, and you were talking about the fact that there had been this windstorm that had come through here that had opened up, you know, some patches that allowed for, you know, regrowth and a diversity of growth. You know, one of the things that we hear about in terms of climate change, and I think we're all becoming more and more familiar with and experiencing more extreme weather, including high wind vents. And I guess I'm just wondering about, you know, can you have too much of a good thing? Are we beginning to see that in terms of these, you know, high winds that do cause these blowdowns?
Sure. And that's a really interesting and good point. The answer is we don't really know yet. The amount of disturbance, you know, historically, if we're trying to mimic the natural disturbance regimes, which often we're doing when we're trying to do good forest management and good other management, the scale would vary year to year and decade to decade. So yes, typically if we're having more severe wind events, you may have more larger acreages of loss. Again, this sort of happens, but what you can end up is the compounding factors of the impacts of climate change. So for example, if we have a large blowdown over a large scale area, or a large insect outbreak, and by the way, insects, given a longer growing season, could have more generations, and that could mean some severe impacts, especially some of these bugs like emerald ash borer. But so talking about having too much of a good thing when we're talking about disturbances, it's going to depend on the compounding factors. Sorry, we'll get to this one again. Let me retrace. Yep. You have the big acreage of a windthrow. You have a lot of downed wood that's drying. One of the other potential impacts of climate change is maybe a little increase in the amount of precipitation, but often that same amount of precipitation is concentrated in larger and larger events. So if we have some prolonged periods of drought, we're increasing our fire risk. We have a fuel load from a blowdown or from an insect impact, and we have some drought, we potentially could have more wildfires in our part of the world than maybe historically, or the severity may have been more than it was.
Got it. So it's really, you have to really look at the full complex of changes that are taking place. And really, it also sounds like to some extent, we're kind of doing a big experiment. We really don't know what the results of that experiment are going to be at this point. So I want to come back again to another kind of framing, and that is, so in terms of the management side of working with forests like this, are there ways that, you know, we can do better in terms of really kind of packing more carbon away, putting more carbon from the atmosphere into the forest like the one we're standing in at this point in time?
Yes, there are a number of things that can be done, not only when we're talking about like packing carbon away and mitigation, but also adaptation to make these systems more resilient in the face of a changing climate. And there's some really great stuff that has come out of NIACS, N-I-A-C-S, which is the Northern Institute of Applied Climate Science. Please look them up on Google. They're fantastic. They had tons of great resources. But they do have several pieces that talk about good management for climate. And some of those things are as simple as extending some rotations. Some of those are more expanding the species mix that occur in these areas, you know. So and a good example of where a climate adaptation strategy that's also a mitigation strategy, we're looking at issues in northern Wisconsin and even worse in northern Minnesota where there are black ash swamps. And naturally, these systems are often monotypic, as in there's a lot of black ash and very little else. And with that threat of emerald ash borer, we're already seeing some of these systems altered badly with a lot of dying trees. And the really cool thing, I talked about that machine of photosynthesis earlier, these plants that do this incredible thing. What they also do is pull tons of water out of the ground. And these wetland systems, those trees are transpiring, they're evaporating, they're pulling water up. And what it basically is doing is holding the water table down a little bit. So when you lose that evapotranspiration, in certain cases, you may cause the swamping of some of these wetlands, they become open water. So one of the strategies we're working on is how do we either underplant these black ash stands before they go, or manage gaps to create adequate environment to plant certain other species that are adapted to these wetland types that, one, they start growing fast, start pulling a lot of carbon out of the air, and over time, they replace that evapotranspiration of what was being done by the black ash. Meanwhile, you're creating hopefully a species mix that isn't a monotype anymore. Mm-hmm. It isn't just black ash. It's some of these other species. Maybe it's swamp white oak. Maybe it's red maple. Maybe it's even American elm that might be resistant to Dutch elm disease. And there are other things. We're trying a lot of experiments right now with what is going to be best suited for this. But the idea is if you have a mixed forest, one bug isn't going to come in and wipe that out the next time. So you're making this forest, hopefully, more adaptable, more resilient in the face of climate change, and you're sequestering a bunch of carbon by replacing this and keeping those areas from swamping.
Right, so that really sounds like a win-win. You get more diversity and you're putting more carbon away. So a question I think that's kind of related to that, I think I'm of the age where I tend to identify as being, wilderness, as being the ultimate, goal. I grew up in the era of, the Ansel Adams photograph, sure. And that was really the pinnacle of what you wanted to strive for. But what I'm hearing here also is that there's ways to manage that allow for production, but also still being able to maintain that biodiversity and all these benefits that we're talking about.
Right. And that's a really good point, as I get bit by another mosquito. Yeah. One of the downsides of being, yes, it is part of the biodiversity. There are a number of things that can be thought about. And some of those, and we live in a working landscape. You mentioned wilderness. And unfortunately, I believe that there aren't enough areas set aside for that. That's something I think we can do better at. Mm-hmm. And again, getting back to that social piece, but the reality of the situation is that in Wisconsin, you have an industry that's $25 billion annually and employs more than 60,000 people.
That's big.
And we can have our cake in some cases and eat it too. It depends a lot about having smart and good management across the landscape, and most of the forest industry does exactly that. When we're talking about carbon, some of these things, I would phrase it like this: how the industry has adapted in the last 100 years have been in many ways where we slightly altered what we're doing in order to come to a better outcome. And one of those things, let me give you an example, was the administration or the beginning of using the best management practices for water quality. Mm-hmm. So this is, typically voluntary, but most do this, especially if they're certified to have a forest certification. They follow these best management practices around wetlands and lakes and rivers and streams in order to ensure that the management is not impacting the water quality. The forest management industry adapted to this, mm-hmm. and has embraced it, understanding that it's good for the longevity and the sustainability of our forested systems, and is recognizing these co-benefits we've been talking about. So when I look at managing for carbon, at this point, there's going to be no mandates. This will be voluntary. But a lot of the things that are good for carbon and climate change and adaptation are simply good forest management practices. And some of those things are leaving more dead wood on the ground, leaving standing dead trees. And the reason you do that is because, yes, they decay and they emit carbon, but it's a slow emission over time. And the co-benefit is that stuff is so great for wildlife habitat, many different species that use it.
So one of the things I think I'm hearing in terms of thinking about how to manage for more, carbon, in the natural system, carbon sequestration, to use the big science word, is it's not really rocket science. In a lot of ways, we really already know how to do this. We maybe just need to do it a little bit better, a little more robustly.
Yes, partially. And the other thing is to better understand the challenges that we're facing. In some cases, there's noted, for example, a lack of forest regeneration in certain systems. And that is a number of things. It's been attributed to deer. It's been attributed to invasive species. It's been attributed to past management practices, all of things. And we at the DNR are working on better grappling with that issue, like how do we better regenerate? But this is imagine, as I talked about, establishing these young trees that start growing really fast and really sucking a lot of CO2 out of the air is important. And if that establishment is delayed, we're waiting a little longer for trees to establish. That engine isn't pumping as quickly. And so you have a delayed effect. So, really thinking about how we can get a kickstart or a head start and improve our forest regeneration is a really important point here. Because, you know, there's so many things that can have caused problems like this. Forest regeneration is really critical. And we at the DNR are taking that really, really, really seriously right now.
Right, because clearly the time is now in terms of climate change. We really need to be thinking about how do we get as big a response as quickly as possible.
Right, yeah, exactly. And there are other things where we have things we just don't control. I mentioned emerald ash borer earlier. There are a lot of insects and disease out there that could cause a lot of loss of biomass and ultimately emit carbon because of the mortality that those things can cause to trees. There are a lot of other issues. You mentioned sort of the events that occur, like fire, like wind throw, a tornado, flooding. All these things can have an impact and, you know, cause damage to forests, cause carbon to be released. And we need to not only, you know, we need to be able to hopefully adapt to some of these issues, but I think it's important that we're acting quickly when we can in order to continue to pull carbon out of the air. So, using more planting or some of these things in these forested systems to restore them when we can.
Right. So, you know, here we are, we're in the middle of an old growth, essentially hemlock forest. So in terms of thinking about, you know, packing carbon away, you know, how much diversity is there when we look at different types of forests? Are some forests going to be more effective, in this capacity than others? And how do we take that into consideration?
Sure. And a lot of this really is about the capability of the habitat that we're in. You can look at different parts of the state and find vastly different sets of ecological and abiotic, actually not ecological, situations or conditions that either help forests and other communities be rich or more on the poor side. So for example, in some of these areas where the Northwest Sands or the Central Sands, it's outwash sandy plains from the glaciation. These soils tend to be very poor nutrient-wise, and they don't hold as much water as some thicker, loamier soils. And so just by nature, a richer site, typically trees and other plants grow faster, grow larger, and put away more carbon than on poorer sites. The importance again about this, and the other thing I guess I'll get at is wetlands. When we're talking about carbon, especially in peatland systems, they can store as much as 50% more carbon, and it's mostly in the peat and in the soils, those thick mats of peat, than in the adjacent uplands just a few feet away. And that's really important to think about when we're talking about the differences across the dry to wet gradient that is the state of Wisconsin. And now we look at a system, and I'll bring up Pine Barrens because I love barrens. It's not a forested system. It's a dry, droughty area. It's a historically common system in the sandy parts of the state. Mm-hmm. It's now much more rare. As a matter of fact, it's a globally rare natural community. And it's typically, the characteristics of it, really low tree density, somewhere between 2 and maybe 10 or maybe even 20 trees per acre, just pretty sparse. And then the flora is unique, similar in some cases to prairie flora, a lot of grasses and a lot of wildflowers. But because those soils are sandy and don't hold as much carbon as, say, those loamier soils, that system is relatively carbon poor. Am I saying we should not have pine barrens? Let's check back to what I just said.
Yeah, right.
This is a globally rare natural community that merits a lot of protection and management. We should keep this out there because of the creatures and the plants that this thing supports. Is that carbon friendly or climate change friendly? I would say in some sense it's giving heterogeneity on the landscape, so it has some adaptability and resilience, positivity to it. But from a carbon perspective, strictly, it's a natural habitat. It's not horrible, but it's not as big as some of those other ones. So we always have to look at these things, I think, with the eye of the bigger picture. Add these things on top of each other. And ultimately, when we're adding carbon onto these things like biodiversity and social issues like recreation and timber production for the industry that it drives, and we add carbon and we add wildlife management, Most of these things are not necessarily mutually exclusive. We can find win-wins. Are they easy? Not always, but some of them are. And that's, I believe, what sustainable forest management is.
Right. That's great. You know, just as an aside, I really always appreciate hearing someone who's a champion of Pine Barrens. You know, the other thing I was just thinking about, though, was, you know, the consideration of scale. So a lot of these, you know, a lot of these smaller plant communities, these little niche ecosystems like bogs or pine barrens, I guess the pine barrens are actually more extensive, you know, their value maybe is most appreciated when we look at a larger scale. So if, like, we're just looking at an acre, maybe we don't appreciate it. But when we really think about the diversity, I guess, ultimately, even at a state level or beyond, then we really begin to see how important they are to preserve and how, and maybe in the big picture, yeah, even in terms of climate change, they really have value.
Yeah. And again, I what's important, I think, what you bring up is really visible from the air. I mean, if you look at aerial photography, you can see the patchwork across the landscape. And some of those things from photos and from satellite imagery that become really clear, where we have large blocks of contiguous natural communities, not just forests, but wetlands and open water and prairies and everything else, that's where we have an opportunity to really, I think, maintain the carbon that's there, but also that impact of the ecology. So whenever we have the opportunity to have these large blocks of contiguous, doesn't have to be forest, right? And it really doesn't. It just, you know, natural communities. Doesn't mean not managed either. It means managed. But what the idea here is that when we have those sorts of opportunities, those are the creams of the crop. And we are guilty of it at DNR. We sometimes look at that 1 acre patch and say, well, this is really cool. And it is. Our responsibility with those gems, I'll call it, and a lot of times I think of that in natural prairie, undisturbed prairie soils that are so rare in the state. Yeah. Often they're really small and they're really isolated. If you look at me, our responsibility is to attempt to buffer those areas and create that protection that way. So again, scale is important. We need to think about the gems, and we also need to think about everything in between.
Yeah, so that really comes back to that framing of scale that we really need to, sometimes we really need to zoom in, but other times we really need to maintain that big picture perspective. They're kind of all important.
Right, and that scale piece, again, I talked about a 1 acre little prairie remnant that may be locally very important, and the biodiversity that it holds is really interesting and important. But again, it even becomes more important if that area is buffered and surrounded at the larger scale. Right. So when we look at things from space, and we look at these areas that have a lot of natural land cover, it is really cool. Now, again, I don't want to suggest either that we should be not growing, doing agriculture in the state, right? We need to feed ourselves. And so agriculture is part of this. But sometimes I think that we can look at that matrix and sometimes use agriculture in some ways to our advantage. When we're thinking about some of these biodiversity concepts and corridors and larger scale continuous environments, we can think about agriculture within that matrix in the sense that it can offer some other benefits, not just about natural communities. So again, I'm not trying to bash the ag industry.
Right.
Ag is so critically important, both economically and frankly, for everyone who eats anything.
So how can residents of Wisconsin play a role in preserving and enhancing, you know, our state forests, and I guess even beyond, I guess both in terms of reducing climate change, but, you know, more broadly in general?
Educate yourselves. Understand what you can do. And understand that you have a voice in this. And whether that's joining the friends group of a state forest or a state park, or whether it's voting, or whether it's simply looking at your own yard and saying, I'm going to plant a few extra trees here. Or it's, you know what, I'm going to let this go a little longer. Or I'm going to actively get in here and get rid of these invasive species and try to promote the natural, the normal native species that might be there, that should be there. So I think that's the important part, is people should act, but they should educate themselves about how to act. And there's so many good resources out there that can help with this. And I urge people to just educate themselves.
That's a great, I think that's a wonderful kind of closing thought. This has been great. Really appreciate your time for this interview today. Andy, any kind of closing thoughts that you have? Or
no, let's get back into the woods and walk around some more. This is too nice of a day to be talking out here.
It's a deal. Thank you again.